This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Tracy Baim, the author of a fascinating new book called Obama and the Gays, A Political Marriage. Baim is co-founder and publisher of Windy City Times, one of the oldest gay publications in America. Congratulations on that. Tracy Baim, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yep, Baim. That's correct.
Now, you've been covering Obama, it happens, longer than maybe any other journalist or almost any other journalist in the country. Tell me how you first got on the Obama beat.
Well, in Chicago, for Windy City Times, we do poll all sorts of political candidates on races. So that includes any race across the state of Illinois. We send surveys out. So in 1996, we sent a survey out to Obama when he was running for state senate. And it just so happened that he did reply. Not a lot of candidates do. And he replied in his own way. He typed out the answers in full, didn't just answer yes or no. And so that's when we were first introduced to him. And uncontroversially at the time, he basically said he was for same-sex marriage, and he was pretty much 100% on all the issues at the time.
And what got you into journalism in the first place?
Well, I definitely come from a journalism family, a kind of environment and genetics. My mother and my stepfather both were very much involved in 1960s Chicago Tribune coverage and the 1968 Democratic Convention riots. Both of them covered those. And then my mother was eventually kind of forced out of the Tribune because she wanted to cover hard news, and they didn't want women covering hard news. So she was a freelancer in many ways across the 3 decades after that, but she also was the managing editor of the Chicago Defender. So I kind of had an alternative path in front of me as well as a mainstream path. And as an open lesbian, I really felt like alternative was the way to go.
Mm-hmm. And did you get from her growing up or from her work at the Chicago Defender, this interest in racial justice?
Absolutely. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood that was basically 98% black in Chicago. My parents were very much kind of urban pioneers in that sense. And all my, you know, going to school, I went to very integrated schools. In fact, I got bussed out of our all African-American neighborhood to go to a magnet school in Chicago. So I very much felt like that came from my parents. They wanted to have us understanding the cities we were living in. In part, I think, and I realized this later in life, was that my mother had been sexually assaulted as a young woman in Chicago when she first moved. She actually was from Milwaukee. She moved to Chicago and had been gang raped by a group of black men. And I realized that really informed her life after that point, that she did not want to become someone who hated another race because of what one or two people or three people did in to her.
Wow. And how'd you end up hearing about that?
Well, later in when I was a teenager, when I was 15, our family was subject to a home invasion, and I was actually assaulted by an African-American man in our neighborhood. The police caught him right away, and my mother, we hardly talked about it, but a few years later, my mom came to me and said, you know, I wanted you to know this is what happened to me when I was a young woman, and I don't want you to hate people. And I said, Mom, don't worry about it. You know, all my best friends growing up were African-American, so I would never stereotype that this person, individual that attacked me.
But that must have been a horrifying experience for you.
It was. It was for our whole family. My stepfather almost died. He had 27 stab wounds. My mom and I both had stab wounds, and it was pretty bad. And the way that the media covered it was not that great, even though my parents were in the media. Well, it was because they were in the movie. They sensationalized it. Hmm. You know, our pictures were all over. My picture as a 15-year-old, underage, was used. My name, my full name was used. I had to go to high school 2 days later, and my name had been all over the paper. That was not normal.
What was that like in high school 2 days later?
You know, it was, you know, fortunately I had a really strong family and support network and friends. And what was interesting, around that same time, a African-American girl had been brutally attacked in the Cabrini Green housing projects. And the way that story was covered was pretty bad in terms of a little bit of guilt and why was she there. And there was lots of judgments about that case that were very badly handled. As opposed to my case, of course, everybody knew that this happened in my home and it was an invasion and this guy had a record. They caught him. He was an adult. And so there were not as many nuances to that story as there were, you know, all these negative nuances they were putting on this girl. So I had a pretty clear sense of right and wrong. And this individual did something wrong, and that justice would be done. Now, I have no idea whatever happened to him after he got convicted. He probably got paroled eventually, but he did face 22 years in prison, and we didn't have to go to trial.
You didn't have to testify.
Right. A state law was changed as a result of it. It made it a felony, the kind of crime that he did, a home invasion with a knife. That made it a felony. They changed the law because of it. So that was something I took out of it that was positive. But no, it's something that never goes away. But when my mom told me that, I realized that was really probably why she fought so hard to be on the right side of this issue. And she covered lots of racial justice issues and Martin Luther King marching in Chicago. She went to Birmingham and covered that. She went to the mountains of Cuba and covered Fidel Castro before he had done the revolution. And these were for community papers, too. This was like, I think, a Highland Park newspaper or something. She just wanted to be where the action was throughout her whole life.
And you've picked up some of that, evidently.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Tracy Baim, who's got this new book out called Obama and the Gays, A Political Marriage. And you mentioned that in that 1996 story, when he was running, I guess, for state senate, that he said he was for same-sex marriage. And then you had an interview with him that you describe in this book in January 2004 when he's running for the U.S. Senate, and all of a sudden his position on same-sex marriage has changed a little. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he went from being fully supportive of same-sex marriage during the era of when Defense of Marriage Act first passed by Bill Clinton, to then a little bit later he made it more based on practical issues, and that really people understood that. At the time, civil unions were the priority for a lot of people as opposed to full marriage. And then after that, he started to edge it towards a religious issue. And that's where people really started to get uncomfortable. The separation of church and state issue, as a constitutional lawyer, he certainly knew better than that. But people, again, kind of give him a little bit of slack. As long as he, on a political level, supported the progression of issues, and he did support civil unions, that was kind of enough. At this point in time now as president, what he's doing is very important, and that is that the Justice Department is stopping its defense of the Defense of Marriage Act. And that, again, is a practical way for him to do this without ever saying that he's for marriage. I don't care whether he's for gay marriage or not. It's the legislative side of it that matters most. And he finally is allowing his Justice Department to kind of act on his wishes, which is to not defend it. It's an incredibly complicated issue. It's going to take years for the courts to really resolve it. All we need is one state that allows out-of-state marriages to those have those marriages recognized by the federal government, and that is the biggest domino to fall, because then anybody could get married in, for example, Massachusetts and have those recognized by the federal government for inheritance, Social Security, and all sorts of things.
But early in his administration, the Justice Department was defending the Defense of Marriage Act.
Right. They were defending it kind of badly, actually. They made some mistakes early on in his first year in office. And it was a difficult situation because I don't know that he even knew that the language they were using was kind of comparing it to incest, because they were using justifications from states that don't recognize marriages in other states that were with a different age, you know, an underage person, 16 years old in one state would not be recognized in another. So to compare gay marriages to that, people were really offended, and rightfully so. So that, within a few weeks, the policy changed, and the way they defended the next case changed. So same with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The arguments started to change in the courts to at least be more professional and based on not incest and not pedophilia, all that kind of stuff. So people were, I think, they were impatient in this early phase because of other things that happened, but then eventually he has really kind of fixed a lot of those gaps.
But his own language on marriage, is that changed much? Because I remember in that campaign he said he wasn't for marriage.
Right, and again, he sort of tries to base it on religious issues, even though he really came to religion later in life. So, and he came from a church that was relatively progressive as a denomination on gay marriage. The church in Chicago that was very controversial and headed by Reverend Wright at the time actually comes from a denomination that does support gay marriage. That individual denomination had issues with it, but not the overall denomination. So that's what people thought. Well, first of all, it's being a little late to the table on religion. And second of all, very hypocritical, given his own background, his own parents' marriage, when they were married, 13 states in the United States didn't recognize interracial marriages. So a lot of people just really felt that he wasn't being honest, really, about that, and used a defense that was indefensible, really.
When you were interviewing him in 2004 and he was trimming his sails a little bit on the same-sex marriage issue, did you get the sense right then that he was going to be running for president? Or did you get a sense that in another way, hey, this guy could be the first black president of the United States. Holy smokes.
Well, this was January 2004, so it was a few months before the Democratic Convention speech that he gave. I got a sense that he was being very academic in his approach. In fact, he came to our office with nobody else around. He was just him on his own, and he asked me to turn the tape recorder off when we started to talk about marriage, just to kind of have a conversation. He really is someone who cares to learn about an issue. That's what everybody I interviewed for the book talked about, is that he really actually wants to be educated and to learn. And that's what I felt during that interview. He kept saying, why would you go for something you can't get? Get what you can get, be practical, which was civil unions at the time. And don't worry about the language of marriage, which is easy to say when you're taking an academic approach. But on a practical level, there are actual laws in the land that have the word marriage that come with different benefits than civil unions. So it's separate and unequal. So I didn't get a sense. I actually felt he was very kind of pragmatic and academic and not very politician-like at that point. Later in the year, clearly after that Democratic Convention speech, everybody in Chicago knew that he was going to run at that point. He was just a superstar.
In that presidential race, you say in your book, Tracy Baim, Obama and the Gays, that more gays favored Hillary than Barack. Why was that?
Well, Hillary Clinton had really had a longer career in terms of the spotlight for the gay and lesbian community. She didn't carry with a lot of the negative baggage that her husband had, even though Bill Clinton had set the community back with the Defense of Marriage Act and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He still had a pretty good record on gay issues from the historical perspective of when he was serving. Some people gave him the benefit of the doubt that he was doing those things to fend off worse things, right? That there were going to be worse things down the line. That was the line. And people believed that. But they also did not hold Hillary accountable to those things. So she was able to kind of have this veneer of a very pro-gay. She had appeared at Pride Parades. She'd done a lot of good stuff. The in-depth work she had done paid off. In that race, outside of Chicago, she had the majority of almost every survey you did of LGBT donors and voters because of that. It's just that they didn't know Obama. And so a lot of the people in Chicago who knew Obama really acted as his liaison to the gay community in other cities. One by one, they would try to convince people. And as momentum shifted to him, that made it easier for him to pick up the LGBTs for Clinton. Some of them he didn't pick up until probably election night, and maybe even after.
And did you find yourself in that emissary role?
I did as a journalist. I felt like I was telling them the facts about his career. So people would ask me, you know, what was his comfort level around gay issues, or did he ever appear at gay events? And, you know, we had lots of photos of him appearing at AIDS benefits, gay benefits, and a lot of them are in the book. So we had actual physical evidence, photo evidence, that we shared with other gay media and straight media, just because, you know, objectively, he had done a lot of work on gay issues.
And yet, during the campaign, there were a couple signals that were off-putting. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way, yeah. Especially when he was campaigning with the anti-gay Reverend McClurkin.
Yeah, Donnie McClurkin is a recovering gay. I don't know how you might say it, but he claims to be a recovering gay and very anti-gay. And several other missteps during that campaign. Now, the thing is, Clinton wasn't pure on all this. She made a couple little gaffes as well. People were afraid that he was going to be similar to Clinton or others that had made promises, then once they get in office. So I think the community had been burned so many times that they were just on edge about him. And in essence, he was campaigning the way he said he was going to run as president, which is to have an open tent. And that included people he didn't agree with. And then it came true with Rick Warren at the inauguration.
Which seemed like another slap in the face.
Exactly. And that's why people were on edge those first few months. He did those things that then set the community up to not believe him that he was going to do the good things as well.
And what are some of those good things that he's done?
Well, a significant number of them we document in the book. Early on, the first couple years, really, he was able to appoint many openly gay people, including to Senate confirmation level appointments. At this point, it seems to be on track to be far more than any other president prior to him. The Hate Crimes Act was signed. The HIV travel ban was lifted. Significant policy changes were done that they're not the sexy headline grabbers. And that's, I think, part of his problem is, as a candidate, he was a much better communicator than he has been as president. At the really wide-ranging things he has done that have affected LGBT Americans, healthcare, obviously, people get under, but they don't understand it on a practical level, how many people with HIV now will be covered by that pre-existing condition when it kicks in. So So many people were affected by things that didn't necessarily get communicated as LGBT. The new healthcare changes where gays and lesbians will have access to their partners in hospitals. Millions and millions of LGBTs have been affected by policy changes that are not the headline grabbers like Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that's, I think, why I wanted to do the book. I really want people just to be informed to make an educated decision. And whenever I explain them all in one place, like all 30 things he's done, people are like, oh, I guess I forgot about that, or I never heard about that one, because we so much focus on those four, you know, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the DOMA, the immigration, those kind of things.
And yet you finished writing the book before he really moved forcefully on Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Right. If the book came out right before the election, on purpose, I wanted to, again, document it for folks to see.
This is the 2010 election.
Yeah, 2010 election. And then most of the people in the book that were really insiders felt that there, with 100% confidence, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was coming down by December. When I was talking about the book last fall and touring with it, I said the same thing, because he very clearly in the State of the Union said, this is the process by which we will do this. And he is a process guy. He said, I need to involve the military. The report is due December 1st, and we will act after that. So that's what happened. Now, I'm not saying it was a slam dunk. It was still a lot of maneuvering that happened last fall. But that a lot of people in the book, a lot of people said they didn't believe it was going to happen, but the true insiders, Democratic Party insiders, really said, oh, I'm confident it will happen.
And what's the backstory on that? Was this pushing from the commander-in-chief, from Obama himself, or was it some of the brass who spoke pretty much from the heart and beautifully on this question? Can you sparse that out?
Well, I think Admiral Mullen, for example, he really truly from the heart, he felt this because he had dealings with openly gay and with gay service members. Obama did care about this issue. He has always been against Don't Ask, Don't Tell, from U.S. Senate to presidential candidate. But he knew that Clinton had made many mistakes in trying to eliminate the gay ban, and that's why we had Don't Ask, Don't Tell to begin with. So knowing that he needed footing on this better than Clinton had prepared for, and Rahm Emanuel was right there when Clinton made those missteps, this is how they plotted out the change, to involve the military leadership in it, involve and get rid of, you know, silence the ones that were against it. And therefore, Gates and Mullen really had to be the face of this for it to sell better to the military itself.
They all weren't silenced, though. I mean, the head of the Marines was still outspoken, and I don't know why Obama didn't fire him. I guess the guy only had a couple months left, so.
Yeah, he's playing the game well. What was the political gain to fire him? None. You know, he might have placated a few people who were upset, but the bottom line was the policy. He always keeps his eye on that bigger prize, that's why he pisses off a lot of people on the way, is that he will compromise on some of those lesser things to get the bigger pie.
I'm speaking with Tracy Baim. She's the author of this book, Obama and the Gays, A Political Marriage. It's quite comprehensive and very interesting. I'm Matt Rothschild. You listen to Progressive Radio. One thing he hasn't moved on is this discrimination, ENDA. He hasn't pushed this bill, or this bill certainly has been passed, and this is one of the most egregious aspects of discrimination against gays and lesbians and bisexual and transgender people in this country, that in a majority of the states, and you can tell me how many, it was 33 a few years ago, I know that's still the case, in a majority of the states of this country, a boss can fire you simply for being gay.
That's correct. And what's interesting is many corporations have surpassed states in this issue. Most corporations have, most of the major Fortune 500 have some kind of employment protections for their employees. I think that ENDA, it's not only the commander-in-chief that's to blame on this. I think our community often diverts itself into the sexier, big headline-grabbing issues like marriage. And so we're kind of like this multi-pronged approach that sometimes can therefore hurt some of our issues like ENDA. And there was also a glitch a few years ago on making sure that ENDA was gender identity inclusive. And so that there's a conflict within the movement a little bit on that. Not anymore, but it did slow it down for a while, because even Barney Frank was against it. Now he's for it in terms of that inclusion, because they thought it wouldn't pass. We knew it would never pass again with gender identity, so you have to get both at the same time. So I think part of it's the community in terms of prioritizing. You can't do it all at once. And I know that ENDA is on a front burner now. There's from the legislative point of view, as well as the activist point of view, appointment non-discrimination, inclusive immigration reform, and anti-bullying work, all sorts of other things are very important. And I do want to say that it's interesting, the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton State Department from day one have been very inclusive of any change that's sexual orientation has also included gender identity. So the administration really did get that issue from day one.
Mm-hmm. ENDA is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And do you know how many states are still allow bosses to fire people because
I would have to look it up. Human Rights Campaign and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force track that. What's interesting is most of the larger states do. So well more than half of the population is actually covered. It's just the number of states. Some of the smaller states do not have it.
So if you're listening to this and you want to look it up, go to Google and look up ENDA and states that still discriminate, and you'll find the answer. And as soon as I get to back to the office, I think I'll do that myself. I'm speaking with Tracy Baim here. How's President Obama been on HIV/AIDS policy and HIV spending prevention? Because this is one area actually where George W. Bush was good, actually.
Yeah, he was good at the budget wasn't cut. It was added too slightly. The funding issue, because of the overall funding problems we're having, is not good. There are people that are very concerned about that. But he finally did implement a national AIDS strategy, which was something that had been asked for over two decades. He did sign the lifting of the HIV ban. George Bush had initiated the process, but it actually came under Obama to sign it.
And this is to let people in the country who are HIV positive.
Yeah, believe it or not, this country banned people who are HIV positive from traveling here for over two decades. And then internationally, there's definitely concern about the U.S. contribution to the international battle on HIV/AIDS. So the funding issue is tied up in all the funding issues we're seeing right now. But the Department of Housing and Urban Development has been doing work on this in terms of funding AIDS housing. And so there is stuff happening in the National AIDS Strategy, and the people appointed to this National AIDS Advisory Group are actually really strong and not political appointees. They are really people who know the issue. So if he does get a second term, there is really strong hope that this will be an issue he will be strong and progressive on throughout his terms.
Do you think he's going to get a second term?
Well, boy, I certainly don't see a crystal ball in front of me, but I can't imagine. It's his to lose. But this country is pretty crazy right now. And whether he wins or not, obviously he needs to have at least one of the houses, House or Senate, stay Democratic. Obviously, he needs both, but if at least one stays, then he can fend off stuff for another couple of years. My big worry is that he would get in, but he would lose both House and Senate, and then we're just again in a stalemate, like our council wars in Chicago. So that's really a huge worry.
Tracy Baim, tell me about this pretty crazy country we're living in, as you put it. What do you make of the thunder from the far right and the Tea Party people and the reactionary wave that seemed to have just crashed across the country? I know the Tea Party's diminishing in popularity, but boy, I saw a poll that had that headline, and then I looked deep in the article and said 33% of people still support the Tea Party, which is shocking to me.
Yeah, it's very shocking to me. I think what happened is they filled a void. The Democratic Party, especially the progressive side of it that helped elect Obama, rested. And in that rest, in that void, that August void, they filled it. And they obviously are well-funded and manipulatable. I wish that I could sensibly talk to Tea Party people to track for them how they are being manipulated by people who care nothing about their actual interests. They do not get that. It's sad, and it's very pathetic, really, that they're basically doing the bidding for the Koch brothers and other people like that against their own interests.
But how would you talk to them if they hate you because you're a lesbian?
Well, this is the thing about original founders of that Tea Party movement were not... They wanted it to be focused on economics. They were taken over by the social conservatives. That's why they're losing some of their people. A lot of the people even in the Christian right don't want these social issues to dominate anymore, at least gay issues. They're probably still on the abortion issue. But on gay issues, a lot of them are not as conservative as they used to be. They just want it to go away. It's not that they're for gay marriage, but it's not a priority as much as it used to be. So I really believe that's why the Tea Party's even getting more divided, is because they're getting back to these social issues that it wasn't founded out of.
Mm-hmm. In the gay community, on the left of the gay community, there in the whole progressive community right now, there's a segment that is quite disillusioned with President Obama for a variety of reasons, including Afghanistan, the compromise on health care, the tax cuts for the wealthy, any numerous things, not doing enough on the economic recovery package. John DiMilio, who is a great historian of gay America, has a line in your book, Obama and the Gays, that says the opportunity has slipped away, the opportunity that the Obama presidency afforded us as progressives. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I agree. The Democrats had control the first 2 years. They said they just needed control and they would make the changes. I think they underestimated the power of the right. They were not going away. But also, I really believe the progressive movement in some ways didn't stay around strong enough. I don't believe it's gone. I certainly don't believe we don't have a chance to change it again. And I think if let loose in a final 4 years with a Democratic control, the changes we would see would be sweeping. I miss Molly Ivins for that reason. She was so good at pointing out the little minutiae of government and Bush's, you know, way of W. Schrub's way of being. I miss her so much in that way that she would have shown that actually Obama's done a tremendous amount to change that we don't see. It's not enough. He has to operate in a real world we journalists and academics sometimes don't understand, and that's not to give him any slack. But if we give up, if we say, well, he's not good enough, we will get what we don't vote for. And that's my concern, is that by staying away from the polls last fall, we punished our friends. We helped our enemies. And that's not the answer in 2012. We punished them. Okay, they got the message. And hopefully we can less red dog, or, you know, what do you call them? Blue dog Democrats. What do you call them? Red dog Democrats. I can't remember. Blue dog Democrats. More progressives across the table. And that'll give Obama the legislation that that is more in line with the progressive movement. But we get what we elect.
I love the shout out to Molly Ivins you just did, and it's in your book, Tracy Baim, Obama and the Gays. She wrote for The Progressive for 20 years, mm-hmm. and she's been gone since 2003, which is just kind of astonishing. It's been that long, and mm-hmm. and I miss her terribly. So it's fun to see her remembered there. Thanks for that.
Mm-hmm.
You also tell people to keep up the pressure, the protest pressure, this not only inside strategy, but outside strategy. Talk about that a bit.
I very much think that Obama gets the outside strategy push, and he wants that. He certainly doesn't oppose it. Like, he's a guy in the streets when he was running and before he was an elected official. So I would say that the two-pronged approach, multi-pronged approach of outsider insider was the reason we were able to for sure get DADT removed last year. We had people getting arrested at the White House. We had people going to black tie galas. We need that for sure. And we need to keep that pressure up for union rights or immigration rights or whatever it is going to be. We need the people in the streets and we need the people in the suits.
And by the people in the streets, do you mean heckling Obama sometimes? Because I know there have been members of the gay community who have done that. How does that make you feel?
I like it. You know what? All power to him. If they've got that energy and that's their feeling and that they don't feel he's doing enough, go right ahead. He's going to answer what he can, and he does get frustrated with that sometimes. But I think it's totally important that he never forget that there's always going to be more to accomplish.
You quote Jonathan Alter, who wrote a book about Obama's first year, and Obama advisors said that gay issues were distractions. Do you believe that they're distractions for the president?
No, I don't. And I think that they underestimate the fact that more people care about gay issues than ever before that who are not gay. So we really need to make sure they understand that it is part of a progressive agenda in a way that has never been before.
It's funny, in your book, along those lines, you have Barney Frank saying, in 20 years, all gay issues will be resolved, will be won. And I thought that was just a tremendous prediction. And we're going to have to end it on that happy note. I hope that comes true. Tracy Baim, author of Obama and the Gays, A Political Marriage, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.